Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly Higher Education Report, Pete Musto reports on efforts to provide aid for students from low-income families to go to college. Then, you will hear words and their stories. Ana Mateo tells us about New Year's resolutions. And then, we will present the making of a nation. Today, we mark the Martin Luther King holiday with a special program on civil rights by Steve Ember. As you can hear, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here is Pete Musto with the Higher Education Report.
Many people believe a college education can help any hard-working person. But not everyone is able to attend a college or university. One common barrier is money. The College Board collects information about colleges and universities across the United States. The organization recently investigated how much it costs Americans to attend a publicly supported 4-year college in their home state. It found that the average cost for a single student for the 2016-2017 school year is $20,090. Yet the U.S. higher education system does have other choices. There are 2-year community colleges and private 4-year universities. Also, students must consider what financial aid can do for them. For example, after including federal financial aid, the College Board found that the average yearly cost of a 4-year public college is $14,210. However, this assistance still is not enough for some. So now, a group of 30 colleges and universities are taking action. They have all agreed to be part of the American Talent Initiative. Launched in December, the ATI is a project from a nonprofit leadership organization called the Aspen Institute. It also receives support from the Higher Education Research Group, Ithaca S&R. Their goal? To increase the total number of low-income men and women studying at these 30 schools to 480,000 by the year 2025. Josh Weiner is executive director of the Aspen Institute's College Excellence Program. He says one of the reasons this goal is so important is because of the value diversity adds to education. Students from different races and cultures help each other see and understand the world differently, he says. But students from different income backgrounds also have knowledge to share. And, Weiner notes, ensuring equal chances for everyone is an important part of the American identity.
So I think if we believe in the American dream, which is that hard work should enable you to go as far as your talents can take you, we've got to do something about this.
Weiner admits this can be a problem. Any school wishing to join the program must have at least a high graduation rate. 70% of the students must successfully complete their study program. But only 270 of the thousands of U.S. colleges and universities meet this requirement. And the 30 schools currently involved are all different. Some are large public research colleges. Others are small private universities. The problem also has several causes, Weiner adds. For example, one reason there are so few low-income students in college is a lack of recruiting. Weiner says schools not only need to find better ways of finding low- and middle-income students with the ability to succeed, they also need to be better about letting these students know what financial aid is available. Many of these students do not think any top college would want them to attend, let alone help them pay the cost, Weiner says. However, simply providing financial aid is not as simple a solution as it might appear. While the largest amount of aid comes from the government, financial help can also come from a college or university's endowment. Most schools only spend small amounts from their endowments each year, hoping not to spend more than the return on their investments. But a 2016 report from the research group Education Trust argues some colleges and universities have more than enough money to share. Andrew Nichols is director of higher education research for the group. He also helped write the report. It found that 138 U.S. colleges each had an endowment worth over $500 million. Also, the cost of about 4 out of every 5 of these schools is more than 60% of the average yearly family income of low-income students. Nichols argues that by increasing endowment spending, even in small amounts, large endowment schools could give more aid. Yet they often reject increased spending, he says, because a large endowment is a quality that makes them more desirable.
I think the resistance really comes from a place of wanting to amass a great amount of wealth.
But Liz Clark says a school cannot spend its endowment money any way it likes. Clark is with the National Association of College and University Business Officers. She notes that donors often place legal restrictions on how money they leave to the endowment is spent.
So, in some cases, donors may have restricted funds specifically to help low-income students, and in other cases, donors may have said, I'd like my funds to be used to help support the library or perhaps the music department. And while it is extremely important for colleges and universities to build a diverse student body, they need to have the faculty, the resources, and the educational offerings that make those institutions great, and it takes dollars to help make that happen.
Clark adds, if schools give out more and more in financial aid each year, they will likely have little or no endowment money to use in the future. This means the school will be in trouble if it has any financial difficulties in the coming years. However, there is some middle ground on this issue, says Catherine Hill. She served as president of Vassar College for 10 years before she joined Ithaca S&R in 2016. Hill notes the unequal educational experiences young people from different backgrounds have in the United States. A lot of aid is merit-based, meaning it goes to students performing at the highest level. This often goes to wealthier students, as they have had more educational resources. Weiner, Nichols, and Hill agree that more aid should be need-based, or should simply go to the students with the greatest need. But Hill says even that is a complex solution.
We want the talented low- and middle-income kids, but their families now can't afford to pay nearly as much relative to the high-income kids. And that means we have to allocate more money to need-based financial aid. That means we have less resources to spend on the things that help us attract those high-income kids. So we're operating in a much more complicated environment today than schools were 40 years ago.
Hill offers one possible solution. Schools can reorganize their spending. Also, as Andrew Nichols says, schools could ask for less restrictions on donations, as they used to do in the past. Otherwise, he adds, higher education is at risk of becoming another privilege of those with the most money. I'm Pete Musto.
Now we are in the middle of the first month of the year. On Words and Their Stories, Anna Mateo tells us about making New Year's resolutions. Here is Anna.
Resolution is a word with more than one meaning. However, when talking about a new year, a resolution is a promise people make to themselves to be better. The person decides to make a serious effort to do something over the next 12 months. Many people use the start of a new year as a time to try something new or change something about themselves. This use of resolution dates back to the late 1700s. These earlier resolutions were usually of a religious nature. However, these days, New Year's resolutions are usually about living healthier, having more success, and finding greater satisfaction in life. So, some common New Year's resolutions are to lose weight, exercise more, keep in contact with family and friends, stop smoking, save money, go back to school, cut back on alcohol, or get more or better sleep. Some people may make a New Year's resolution to improve only one area of their life. Others may feel they need to completely change everything. These people may use the new year as a time to turn over a new leaf. Turning over a new leaf means to make a change and behave in a more responsible manner. At the start of a new year, you can wipe the slate clean. This means you can simply wash away all the mistakes you made from the past year, as one would remove chalk from a school blackboard. Just remember that before you start from a clean slate, learn from the mistakes you made. If not, you may have to go back to the drawing board. This means that your plan or method is not working. So, you have to go back and develop a new solution to the problem. People who draw images, such as cartoonists, use a drawing board. The phrase, go back to the drawing board, comes from Peter Arno, who worked as a cartoonist for New Yorker magazine. In 1941, he made a cartoon showing military men running toward a crashed plane. The designer of the plane is seen walking away with his designs under his arm. The caption says, "Well, back to the old drawing board." So, for many people, the new year is a good time for a fresh start. Still, many people do not make New Year's resolutions. They do not want to put added pressure on themselves. Or they are just happy with what they are doing and how their lives are progressing. And some people may think that there is no reason to try so hard to change yourself. They may agree with the old saying that a leopard never changes its spots. This means you are born as you are born, and no amount of effort can change that. After all, change can be hard. Getting up early to exercise every day is hard. Setting aside time every day to learn a new language or musical instrument is not easy. As we get older, it might be even more difficult for people to change their behavior. Maybe that's why we say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm Ana Mateo. Have a happy new year.
Monday marks the birth of American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Today, we have a special Making of a Nation program on the civil rights movement and race relations in the United States. Here is Steve Ember.
Early in its history, black Africans were brought to America as slaves. They were bought and sold like animals. By the time of America's Civil War in the 1860s, many had been freed by their owners. Many, however, still worked as slaves on the plantations or large farms of the South. By the end of the war, slavery had been declared unconstitutional. But that was only the first step in the struggle for equality. Most people of color could not get good jobs. They could not get good housing. They had far less chance of a good education than white Americans. For about 100 years, blacks made slow gains. Widespread activism for civil rights did not really begin until after World War II. During the war, black Americans earned respect as members of the armed forces. When they came home, many demanded that their civil rights be respected too. An organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, led the way. In 1951, the organization sent its lawyers to help a man in the city of Topeka, Kansas. The man, Oliver Brown, and 12 others had brought legal action against the city. They wanted to end racial separation in their children's schools. That policy was known as segregation. At that time, 2 of every 5 public schools in America had all-white students or all-black students. The law said all public schools must be equal, but they were not. Schools for white children were almost always better than schools for black children. The situation was worst in southern states. The case against the city of Topeka, Brown versus the Board of Education, was finally settled by the nation's highest court. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that separate schools for black children were not equal to schools for white children. The next year, it said public schools must accept children of all races as quickly as possible. In September 1957, a black girl attempted to enter an all-white school in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas. An angry crowd shouted at her. State guards blocked her way. The guards had been sent by the state governor, Orville Faubus. After 3 weeks, a federal court ordered Governor Faubus to remove the guards. The girl, Elizabeth Eckford, and other black students were able to enter the school. After 1 day, however, riots forced the black students to leave. President Dwight Eisenhower ordered federal troops to Little Rock. They helped black students get into the white school safely. However, angry white citizens closed all the city's public schools. The schools stayed closed for 2 years. In 1962, a black student named James Meredith sought to attend the University of Mississippi. School officials refused. John F. Kennedy, the president at that time, sent federal law officers to help him. James Meredith became the first black person to graduate from the University of Mississippi. In addition to fighting for equal treatment in education, black Americans fought for equal treatment in housing and transportation. In many cities of the South, blacks were forced to sit in the back of buses. In 1955, a black woman named Rosa Parks got on a bus in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. She sat in the back. The bus became crowded. There were no more seats for white people. So the bus driver ordered Mrs. Parks to stand and give her seat to a white person. She refused. Her feet were tired after a long day at work. Rosa Parks was arrested.
For a number of years, the Negro passengers on the city bus lines of Montgomery have been humiliated, intimidated, and faced threats on this bus line.
The Reverend Martin Luther King organized the black citizens of Montgomery. They were the major users of the bus system. They decided to stop using the buses.
At present, we are in the midst of a protest, the Negro citizens of Montgomery, representing some 44% of the population. 90% at least of the regular Negro bus passengers are staying off the buses, and we plan to continue until something is done.
The boycott lasted a little more than a year. It seriously affected the earnings of the bus company. In the end, racial separation on the buses in Montgomery was declared illegal. Rosa Parks' tired feet had helped win black Americans another victory in their struggle for equal rights. And the victory had been won without violence. The Reverend King was following the teachings of former Indian leader Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi urged his followers to reach their political goals without violence. One of the major tools of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle in America was the sit-in. In a sit-in, protesters entered a store or public eating place. They quietly asked to be served. Sometimes they were arrested. Sometimes they remained until the business closed, but they were not served. Some went hours without food or water.
Buses are a coming. Oh, yeah.
Another kind of protest was the Freedom Ride. This involved buses that traveled through states from the north to the south. On freedom rides, blacks and whites sat together to make it difficult for officials to enforce racial separation laws on the buses. Many freedom rides and much violence took place in the summer of 1964. Sometimes the Freedom Riders were arrested. Sometimes angry crowds of whites beat the Freedom Riders. Perhaps the most dangerous part of the civil rights movement was the campaign to win voting rights for black Americans. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution said a citizen could not be denied the right to vote because of race or color. Several southern states, however, passed laws to try to deny voting rights to blacks for other reasons. Martin Luther King and his supporters demanded new legislation to guarantee the right to vote. They held protests in the state of Alabama. In the city of Birmingham, the chief law officer ordered his men to fight the protesters with high-pressure water hoses and fierce dogs. People throughout the country watched the demonstration on television. The sight of people, including children, being beaten by policemen and bitten by dogs, awakened many citizens to the civil rights struggle. Federal negotiators reached a compromise. The compromise was, in fact, a victory for the protesters. They promised to stop their demonstrations. In exchange, they would be permitted to vote.
The Freedom Train!
President Lyndon Johnson signed a major civil rights bill in 1964. Yet, violence continued in some places. Three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. One was murdered in Alabama. Martin Luther King kept working toward the goal of equal rights. On April 4, 1968, he died working toward that goal. King was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone there to support a strike by waste collection workers.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face.
CBS newsman Walter Cronkite.
Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
A white man, James Earl Ray, was tried and found guilty of the crime. A wave of unrest followed the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. Blacks in more than 100 cities in America rioted. In some cities, areas affected by the riots were not rebuilt for many years. The movement for civil rights for black Americans continued, but it became increasingly violent. The struggle produced angry, bitter memories. Yet it also produced some of the greatest words spoken in American history.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Tomorrow on this program, we will continue the story of the United States in the 1960s. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.